take RN for a walk, stream or download.
And hello, good morning to you, Natasha Mitchell joining you now on RN for Life Matters for the next hour. Hope you had a great weekend. Did your football team win or did they lose? Very sorry to see that the Fremantle Dockers didn't make it after all those years and all that passion from the West. Look, in a moment, debates over ideology and evidence when it comes to children's reading. And also another debate. Recently we had an American researcher join us to contest what she saw as an overly pessimistic view of fertility for women in their late 30s. Her interrogation of the data suggested a more optimistic picture. Well, Australian fertility specialists have got in touch, as you can imagine, and they want to push right back at her claims, and they join us later on the program today. Also, a hairy dilemma coming up today in our Modern Dilemma series. Hairy in the literal sense. Get ready to fondle that stray hair chin that you've learnt to ignore. And don't forget, you can be in touch on any of our stories throughout the show. We're on Twitter at RN Life Matters is our Twitter name, and you can text us too, which is 0418 226 576. Earlier this year, the then Minister for Schools, Peter Garrett, painted a glum picture for childhood literacy in this country. In a newspaper piece, he reminded us that around 75,000 students in years 5, 3, 7 and 9 who sat the NAPLAN tests last year aren't meeting national minimum standards, that 1 in 4 grade 4 students are not meeting international benchmarks in reading, and in the most recent tests in 2010, Australia performed the worst out of all English-speaking countries, and our score was lower than that of 21 other countries. The picture is worse, of course, for disadvantaged children, socioeconomically and otherwise. What's going on here? Learning how to read can certainly be a struggle. It's not an easy thing to do. But how are we going when it comes to teaching children how to do it, and also teaching teachers to teach children how to do it? The Centre for Independent Studies has released a paper today in the Journal of Policy, I think, with a sharp headline, Why Jaden Can't Read: The Triumph of Ideology Over Evidence in Teaching Reading. So what is the ideology and what is the evidence that they're referring to? Joining me now is the one of the report's authors, Jennifer Buckingham, who is a research fellow specialising in education at the Centre for Independent Studies. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thanks, Natasha.
And also with us on the line is Dr. Jan Turbell. She's a senior fellow in the Faculty of Education at the University of Wollongong. She specialises in early literacy. She's on the editorial boards of several academic journals, including Reading Teacher and Reading Research Quarterly for the International Reading Association. Welcome, Jan.
Good morning. Thank you.
Jennifer, the triumph of ideology over evidence in teaching reading. What specifically is the ideology that you're referring to here?
I'm referring to an ideology that suggests that children don't need to be taught explicitly the code strategies required to learn to read. And that's particularly, I'm talking about the initial years of school. So there's a focus on encouraging the love of language, love of literature, reading great books, and all of that is wonderful, and I don't want to set this up as an either-or debate. For me, it's an and argument, that you can have all of those things, but you also need to incorporate the strategies that have been shown scientifically to be very effective for teaching children how to read.
So you're talking about the mechanics of learning to read, and this is the age-old, what you describe as the reading wars, dichotomy that has been set up, perhaps falsely, I don't know, between a kind of phonics approach to learning how to read and what's been described as a whole language approach.
Yeah.
Just distinguish those for us.
Well, like a lot of debates that go into the public sphere, the two sides tend to become exaggerated and simplified. And it's really, as I said, it's a matter of and. So it's including phonics in an integrated, comprehensive reading program, And I would say that most schools say that they do teach phonics. However, there is a very particular way of teaching phonics that has been shown to be the most effective. So it's not enough to talk about or point out letter sounds as you're doing a shared reading in a classroom.
So this is phoneme awareness. This is the kind of precursor, isn't it, where you're kind of breaking down words into their component sounds, like k-at.
That's right.
Max cat.
That's right. And phonemic awareness is more about the oral language ability, so being able to hear the sounds in words and that a word is made up of distinct sounds. Phonics then makes the connection between those sounds and the letters that are on the page. And some children will just pick that up implicitly. But there are quite a number of children, and these are generally the ones that we see in those statistics of not achieving a sufficient level of reading. They need to be taught those strategies and those skills and that knowledge explicitly and in a really careful and systematic way, or they will have great gaps in their knowledge.
Your argument here is that the quality of teaching reading is highly variable in Australia. How do you know that?
I've just looked at research and surveys. So this particular article isn't presenting anything that's brand new in terms of statistics. This is all information that has been on the record for a long period of time. What I and my co-authors, Kevin Weldall and Robin Beeman Weldall, have done is pulled all this information together and tried to understand and then make an argument that this persistent problem, particularly with struggling readers, has to be considered in light of what we know about reading instruction and what surveys and research has shown is being done in the classroom.
So just to take it further, the key argument that you're making here is that teachers aren't being taught the most up-to-date, in terms of scientific evidence, methods for teaching reading to students, that what they're learning is highly variable, and indeed that teachers' literacy themselves is often questionable.
And that is the finding from numerous surveys. So from the National Inquiry into the Teaching of Literacy, so that's from 2005, but more recent surveys as well, that have asked pre-service teachers themselves how confident they are about how to teach literacy, and there are high proportions who say they are not confident, particularly in how to teach struggling readers.
Confidence is different from ability, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, people often undermine their confidence by saying they're not confident.
That's right. But then when you look at the content of teaching courses, and I can't say, I haven't been into every single teacher education faculty, you know, in the last 12 months, so I would really hope that something has changed in the last few years and that they can say, look, you're wrong, everything's different now. That would be nice to know. But a lot of the teachers we have teaching now have been through teacher education courses where there hasn't been sufficient attention paid to the practical and proven teaching strategies.
Let's bring in Jan Turbel here, Senior Fellow at the Faculty of Education at the University of Wollongong and past President of the Australian Literacy Educators Association. Jan, what's your response to this argument that's being made in this paper?
Well, Natasha, I've actually got a copy of the paper because it was released as of yesterday, I believe, and I had an alert on my iPad this morning from one of the newspapers.
Sure, so you've read the paper.
So I've read the paper.
What's your response to its main claims?
Well, let me first take the word ideology over evidence. I think one of the things that I'd like to, I guess, debate a little bit is that the whole notion of ideology, the team that Jennifer's working with, and I have to say, Jennifer, it's an excellent paper. I read it. It's very well argued and come to a very good conclusion. But that's also based on a particular ideology that the team holds, that they do make explicit. So we all have an ideology or set of beliefs or practices, if you like, that underpin our beliefs, that frame how we think and do things. I mean, Thomas Kuhn some time ago called it the paradigm of our thinking. I guess I come from a different paradigm. I agree with lots of things Jennifer has just said and what is actually in the paper. There are a lot of other things, in fact, that I would disagree with, but it's not that I don't agree with the specifics. I agree children should learn to read using their phonic systems and they need to know it. I agree that teacher learning education or teacher education programs in the past may not have focused enough on teaching specifics of reading. However, I think things are changing, and I guess the other thing that I would probably disagree with is that there is only one scientific evidence-based way of teaching kids to read. There are other research focuses or research paradigms that are equally as relevant and equally and actually add a lot of information and evidence to what we do.
How alive are the so-called reading wars in teacher education circles and indeed in the classroom?
Well, I think the reading wars only ever existed really in the media and maybe amongst academics. The average class teacher would just look at you with a look of, I don't know what you're talking about. Basically, I do a lot of work in schools, and if I mention things like reading wars, they just look at you. I mean, teachers take what they think is most appropriate and relevant for the children that they're teaching. And I guess one of the things that I'd like to point out is that the sort of work that Jennifer worked with and in that particular area we're talking about, 10, maybe 12%, 15% at the most of the population. If you look at the other 90% or even 95% of the population of children, say in year three, who have done NAPLAN this year, the evidence is there that the literacy rates actually are increasing, not decreasing.
Okay, Jan, but the claim being made here is that it's not clear, or it is clear at least, that the latest research evidence on how to best teach children reading is not translating into teacher training or into the classrooms, that it's highly variable, that translation, and that that teachers themselves aren't necessarily drawing on the best evidence to inform the teaching of reading in classrooms.
It depends on whose evidence you're talking about. If you're talking about the evidence that Jennifer's pulled together here along with Kevin Weldall and Robin Beeman Weldall, then it's evidence that's of a particular kind within a particular paradigm that underpins a particular research methodology to teach kids to
read.
But
that's very woolly. I mean, the key is that some techniques work and some probably don't work quite as well according to the best evidence.
That's true. In fact, I think that's very true. In fact, it seems to me that as I read through this article at the end particularly, it leads us to the scientific evidence. It always talks about the reading program that's best suited. There are multiple reading programs, in fact, that are suited. And the research of people like Bill Loudon and others in Teachers' Hands, which this document actually indicates, sites and Hattie's work in New Zealand.
But bringing it back to actually what people understand who are listening right now.
Yes, well, let me finish because what I was going to say, Natasha, is their work, and I think more currently the work is of a lot of people are saying it's the teacher who makes the difference. So it's the quality of the teacher, and I agree with what Jennifer was saying about the quality of maybe teacher education, but that has changed and is changing because all our faculties of education or schools of education in all our universities now must be accredited by the New South Wales Teachers Accreditation Authorities or a national accreditation, and they will send it back. We've just gone through that for the second time, so we have graduates out there who went through a university degree where they have focused strongly on exactly the sort of things that Jennifer's talking about.
Jennifer, I need to point out that your co-authors here are the director and chairman, respectively, of a program called Multilit, which has come out of Macquarie University. It's a particular program. Looking at the cost of that program, we looked at the figures. It's not cheap. Is there a potential conflict of interest here in terms of your co-authors and what argument they want to push forward here?
Well, I think that Kevin and Robin's record and academic record and intellectual integrity speaks for itself. I have nothing to gain from this. I'm working for a non-profit research institute. My only interest is looking at the numbers of children, extraordinary numbers of children who have poor levels of literacy, and then what that means then for the rest of their education, and then how we can continue to let this problem persist over, you know, decades without really questioning what are the contributing factors, and sort of, and not putting it in the too hard basket and saying, well, it's because of low socioeconomic status or it's because of funding. Well, no, it's not because of those things. It's because of the lack of translation, the research to practice gap between what we know about teaching reading and what is actually going on in the classroom. And I certainly don't want to lay all the blame at the feet of teachers.
Because
this
we know
partly a policy problem as well.
Parents also make a difference here.
They
we know
do.
That. If
yeah.
they read to their children, it
that
makes
is
a big
right.
difference.
But what happens at school can ameliorate the gaps that occur because of differences in family background. With a really strong, comprehensive reading program can help to close the gaps that are between children when they arrive at school. But as I mentioned, policy is a culprit as well. Government policies on literacy have not been particularly strong. Every so often we have seen something come through which looks very positive and as if it's moving in the right direction. In about 2009, there were some policy documents produced by the New South Wales Department which were terrific. But they disappeared a couple of years later.
With a change of government. I mean, billions of dollars, let's be clear here, have
yes.
been poured into literacy programs in Australia at every level of government.
Right.
Has that money been misapplied?
It has. It's been misdirected, and I think, from looking at the way that policy has been developed, that often that's because it's relying on inaccurate or incomplete information. So reading is a very specific scientific discipline of study. There are experts in this particular area who are very strong on the research evidence and have a great deal of knowledge on this particular set of skills. But not every teacher will have that. So quite often we see advisory committees made up of the usual suspects of people who know a lot about education in general or schools in general. But reading and particularly initial reading instruction and remedial reading instruction are highly specific, and you need to consult experts when you're going to develop policy in that area.
Jan Turbell, what's your response to some of those concerns?
Well, in some ways I'd agree with everything Jennifer says, but I would also say that we're talking about a class of children who have a wide range of abilities or understandings too. So one point you made, Jennifer, was about the schools can ameliorate the issues, and I agree they can. And Belfield School down in Victoria was a good example, and you quote that school in your paper. However, one of the things that when I went into Belfield and explored what
well, you
was
might
making
just
the
explain for the audience what
Belfield
School
was
achieved.
It was a small school with very low socioeconomic background kids, where the school results improved quite dramatically because they the argument was that they had implemented a phonics program, a very systematic phonics program. They had. But when I went into the school and I observed the school over several days, they'd done a lot of other things that had caused that change as well. The kids felt very special. The principal had developed a culture of learning in that school amongst those kids, and that lifted those expectations that you can do anything, kid. And I think this is what I'm trying to say, that the important factor that's missing often in our schools is this lack of culture and lack of support for teachers. So a principal who has a very good learning style and understanding about learning, which is an ideology in itself, and a group of teachers who come together in as a sort of a learning culture can lift all those. And I agree with Jennifer, that's exactly what should be happening. And that's what we're working at trying to do, I think, rather than just looking at one specific little area.
Just briefly, the claim that they make in this paper, Jennifer and colleagues, is that there's an anti-science sentiment that's prevailing in some Australian education faculties and teacher professional organisations. Would you...
Oh, I disagree with that. I think that's just... Again, that comes back to whose ideology are you thinking about or talking about? Because our students read a wide range of different articles and different views. There's a discussion and debate. In this university, for instance, the students do a subject that specifically focuses on children with special needs, and they look at things like teaching phonemic awareness and explicit teaching of phonics. But there are other things in there that they've got to be teaching kids as well, which is for teaching reading particularly, which is the whole area of, it's got to make sense. I mean, you can't just learn sounds. You've got to have a sense that reading is for meaning, and that's something that children have had to carry through what they're doing.
Yes. Jennifer, would you agree with that? I mean, this is not, in some ways you can set up a false dichotomy here, and it's a continuum, isn't it, in terms of technique?
Yeah, of course, and it's never the case that I would say that it's an either-or argument, that it's either phonics or it's the sorts of literacy strategies that encourage reading for meaning and the enjoyment of reading in great literature. It's and it's not enough.
So don't just focus on the context, focus on the mechanics of piecing the letters together.
Yes, and in the early years of school, the emphasis may need to be, for some children in particular, on those code-based strategies. And then as they become more successful with reading and they are actually able to extract some meaning, then you spend more time on vocabulary and comprehension. Having said that, though, all of those components are essential at every point. It's just the emphasis that you place on them at various different stages of reading and with various students. Some students will need more intensive coaching in phonics. Others will already have a fairly good understanding of how language works and will be able to progress more quickly to more sophisticated levels of literacy. And that's where the teacher professional autonomy comes into it. And teachers are very well able to cater for different groups of students. But sometimes there are some bits that are left out, and I think that explains the problem.
All right. Well, no false dichotomies to be constructed on this Life Matters discussion. You've both made very strong points that I think will connect with teachers who are listening around Australia and teacher educators. Can I thank you, Jan Turbell, a Senior Fellow in the Faculty of Education at the University of Wollongong. Thank you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Very much. And Jennifer Buckingham, Research Fellow at the Centre for Independent Studies. Thank you.
Thanks, Natasha.
And get in touch with us, won't you? abc.net.au/radionational. Look for Life Matters. And you can comment on our webpage. You can email us there. And many of you are already having a conversation about it on our Facebook page, as we anticipated. And yes, to some extent, raking over old coals on this one, but evidence counts. On Life Matters, on RN, Natasha Mitchell with you. Coming up next, debunking some myths around fertility.
Hey there, Waleed Ali here. The phones have been running hot for the RN Australian Poetry Slam Wildcard Competition. We've received more than 100 entries, but now it's your turn to have the chance to choose who will represent RN at the national finals. The 6 best performances are on the website. Cast your vote for the performer that you think should be at the national finals of the Australian Poetry Slam, and get it right. We want to win this thing. All the voting details are on the RN homepage. Deadline is 5 p.m. the 2nd of October. Get cracking.
A few weeks back on Life Matters, we interviewed the eminent American social psychologist Professor Jean Twenge. In her book, How Long Can You Wait to Have a Baby?, Twenge argues that some of the statistics on the decline of women's fertility in their late 30s are based on questionable historical data. The program segment really ignited quite a response, as we expected, concerned that Jean Twenge's claims may send the wrong message to Australian couples trying to conceive. The Australian Fertility Coalition asked for a chance to respond. They're running a campaign that aims to educate men and women about factors surrounding fertility, and joining me are two members of the coalition. Louise Johnson is CEO of the Victorian Assisted Reproductive Treatment Authority, VARTA. And Dr. Karen Hammerberg is from the Jean Hales Research Centre or Jean Hales Foundation at Monash University. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Thank you.
Did I get your name right?
Nearly.
Karen?
Karen Hammerberg,
Karen.
Yes.
Yes, great. Thanks for that. Look,
right.
Let's remind ourselves of part of what Jean Twenge's argument was on Life Matters a couple of weeks back. We wanted to play a couple of minutes from that interview for you.
When my husband and I decided we wanted to have children, I was about 34 and decided to try to find some of the research on women's age and fertility, because I love statistics. That's what I do in my day job. So I kept finding. a statistic that said one out of three women over 35 won't be pregnant after a year, will suffer from infertility. So I dug a little bit deeper and found that that statistic comes from a study of French birth records from the 1700s. So that statistic, which is everywhere, is actually based, yes, on women who have who never saw a light bulb. So then I started to find some of the few studies on more modern populations that were much more encouraging.
Well, take us back to that earlier data, though. What did you find so particularly dubious about that data of French women? I think they were French birth records collected by various parishes between 1670 and 1830. What's wrong with that data?
Well, so that's a time before there wasn't modern birth control. But there's just so many differences between that population and the population of modern women now. So first, most of us don't already have seven or eight children by the time we're 35. So at that point, in like California parlance, I like to say, surely those women were saying, dude, get away from me. There may have been some more volitional behavior of saying, okay, maybe we shouldn't be doing this as often. They probably knew about withdrawal. They were probably having sex less often because they were aging together and they had all the kids around the house, probably some of them in their bed. So there's just so many other factors, and that's so different from a modern woman who has good nutrition, has taken care of herself, and maybe even more importantly, can use an ovulation predictor or a fertility monitor to know exactly when she's ovulating, so has a much better chance of becoming pregnant. But just in the last 6 months or so, there's now a sizable body of data from modern women. There's a study that came out a few months ago of almost 3,000 women in Denmark. There's one that's been out for 10 years that was done on 770 European women. So we have more data now, and they suggest much more optimism. They find the difference between trying to get pregnant in your late 20s and your late 30s is only about 4 percentage points different, 82 versus 86%.
Okay, that was what part of what Jean Twenge was arguing on Life Matters a little while back. Louise Johnson, CEO of the Victorian Assisted Reproductive Treatment Authority, what was your response to Jean Twenge's conclusions there particularly?
Well, I imagine that Jean Twenge is motivated by a desire to reassure women and men who are in their 30s and 40s who want children but haven't yet had children that it still is possible. And unfortunately, her comments have been reported in the media under the headline, "Everything that you thought about fertility that you knew is wrong." And that implies that there's no connection between ageing and diminishing fertility for women.
Well, she was not making that claim. She did understand that there is a decline in fertility into your late 30s and particularly into your 40s. What she was disputing there was that historical data, like those French historical birth records, were misguiding us in terms of the actual reality for modern women.
Sure. And I think we know that most men and women want to have a family. However, there is plenty of evidence that shows that the decline in women's fertility speeds up after 35. And I think it's important to bring men into the picture too, because it's not only the age of the woman, but it's the age of the man that interacts in relation to fertility and the capacity to conceive and have a healthy pregnancy and healthy baby.
We'll come to men in just a moment, but I do want to just establish, are we still drawing on that historical data, and just pull back from the mic a bit because you're popping a bit, in order to inform our assumptions about fertility between ages of 35 to 40 for women?
If I could come in there.
Yes, Karen Hammerberg.
It is true that a lot of the data that we refer to when we look at what happens over time in terms of the chance of conceiving and the relationship with woman's age is based on historical data, simply because you couldn't actually do those studies today because women use contraception. But there's not one study that showed that fertility declines. It's about 10 cohorts over about 100 years. They all show exactly the same thing. Nothing much happens up until the age of 35, and after 35 it speeds up.
But do you take her point about the use of that French data and the limitations of that figure that gets bandied around a lot, including on Australian websites, that one out of three women over 35 won't be pregnant after a year?
Well, if that's it's not that one study that shows that. There's a lot of evidence that points in exactly the same direction. And I guess we can argue about whether it's one in three or one in four and how quickly it happens and how many percentage points. There's still a biological fact out there that we're born with the number of eggs we have, and there is a reserve of eggs that after 35 starts to diminish. There are blood tests you can take to measure the amount of remaining eggs, and that's quite helpful. And it's if you look at those more new techniques to evaluate what's left of your fertility, it points in exactly the same direction.
What about the more recent studies, Karen, that she mentioned, the Danish study of nearly 3,000 women and also another European study of 770 women that seem to paint a more optimistic picture, particularly for women under 40?
Yeah, I think one of those studies were specifically about couples who had a very good understanding of when the fertile time of the menstrual cycle was occurring. Mm. And that is very helpful. And that's one of the messages we try to promote is better awareness and better understanding of when in the cycle you're most likely to conceive, because that will definitely help.
Louise Johnson, what were your particular concerns then about Jean Twenge's more optimistic take on fertility for women after 35? I mean, she doesn't deny that fertility doesn't decline, but she wonders whether the data really is indicating that it declines as dramatically as we've been led to believe.
One of my concerns with these particular statements are that, given that most men and women want to have a family, what we want to do through the Your Fertility Project is to inform people about what harms and helps fertility so they've got the best chance to have a family, and as well the number of children that they want. And we want to provide people with the information about the factors that affect fertility, but the single biggest factor is still a woman's age. As Karen mentioned, our biology hasn't changed over 200 years. We're born with the number of eggs we're going to have, and those eggs drop in number until we reach menopause. As well as that, the quality of the DNA can deteriorate in women, but also men in their 40s as well. So that it's not just about conceiving, it's also about having a healthy pregnancy and a healthy baby. And we know that for older women as well, there are complications very often in pregnancy and in childbirth. Well, and risks such as developing gestational diabetes, risks of miscarriage, hypertension, high blood pressure, preeclampsia, and the risks for the baby born as well in relation to childbirth. So there's a lot of reasons why it's much easier, if you're in the position to do so, to try for a baby a bit earlier. And the quality of men's DNA can deteriorate too, which impacts on the time to pregnancy as well.
Well, Karen Hammerberg, on that point around some of the risks around miscarriage and also chromosome abnormalities for women bearing children over the age of 35, Jean Twenge pushed back at those statistics too and wondered whether you were being too alarmist or whether many people are too alarmist. She said that after 35, 99% of babies born to women are chromosomally normal in early genetic tests. Among 40-year-olds, that's 97% of babies being chromosomally normal. So are we being alarmist about this risk?
We have the luxury these days of actually doing prenatal testing, so we can avoid giving birth to children if we choose to, with chromosomal abnormalities. So I guess once they're born, there is a very low risk of chromosomal abnormalities, but probably a lot of those pregnancies have been screened out because women choose to find out early whether the pregnancy is chromosomally normal and actually choose to abort the fetus if it's not. There is a statistic here which includes terminations, spontaneous miscarriages, ectopic pregnancies and stillbirths, and the kind of proportions of pregnancies for women who are 35 that are lost for one of these reasons is about 20%. But amongst women who are 40, that's about 40%. So 40% of pregnancies go under for one reason or another when you're 40.
Yes, Karen, I was very interested to see that Jean Twenge claimed that there are almost no studies on women's fertility in their 40s. That until 6 months ago, she said there was effectively no data at all. There's been one small study. And given that more and more women are leaving childbirth to their 40s, isn't that a major hole in the research?
I guess you can't study something that doesn't happen very often. And I know for a fact that about 4% of births in Australia are to women who are 40 or older. But if you look at the statistics from assisted reproductive treatment clinics, IVF clinics, about 25% of the women who come to seek treatment are over 40. So again, I think women who try later in life to get pregnant will find that it doesn't happen and that they gravitate towards the IVF clinics. And unfortunately, IVF is not all that helpful when you're over 40, and for the same biological reason, that the number of eggs that are of the kind of quality that means that they can actually generate a healthy pregnancy are diminishing, and we're just left with fewer numbers in that sense.
I think you had some concerns about the stats that she gave around IVF. Just remind us what your concerns were there. She was concerned that IVF stats give an overly bleak outlook on women's declining fertility in their 30s.
I think the numbers I read in her article was really that they were giving a very optimistic outlook in terms of if you're over 40 and have IVF, you have every chance of succeeding. Whereas if you look at Australian statistics, a live birth, because you can't just count pregnancies. A lot of IVF pregnancies actually don't eventuate, result in a live birth. But in the latest statistic from Australia is if you're in your, 30 to 34 age bracket, 25% of attempts that you have at having IVF will result in a live birth. But when you're between 35 and 39, that's gone down to 16.9%. So her figures were unbelievable. And I think it's because in America, more embryos are put back every time. So there's a risk of multiple birth, which has its own problems. Whereas in Australia, I think it's practiced a bit more responsibly, I would say. So mostly there's one embryo put back just simply to avoid the risk of multiple birth. But the chance of IVF actually succeeding in women over 40 is minute.
Minute. Louise Johnson.
I'd add to that and say that for many women in their 40s who undertake IVF, they've needed to use donor eggs. And when we read about celebrities in the women's magazines who've had babies in their 40s, what is often not disclosed is that they've often had to use a donor egg to achieve a conception and a healthy pregnancy and baby. And I think it's important to also bring men into the conversation here as well, because if the man is over 40, then the time to pregnancy is likely to be much longer than if it's a younger man.
Yes, you make that point very strongly as part of your campaign, but you also want to... there are other factors too which affect fertility beyond age, aren't there, but perhaps related to age. Louise Johnson, finally to you.
Certainly, and this is one of the aspects we really want to emphasise. While sometimes we might meet somebody until later in life, we may not be able to control our age. However, there are things that we can do related to lifestyle that can have a positive impact on the chances of conceiving, and that includes trying to be of a healthy weight, cutting down on alcohol if you're a smoker, giving up smoking because that has an impact for both men and women, and certainly making sure that you've got a good diet and you get plenty of exercise. And this is for the guys as well as for women as well.
Mm. Look, I thank you both for coming on to respond to some of Jean Twenge's claims. I'm grateful for your time, and it'd be interesting to see what she says in response. We might send her the audio. To you both, Dr. Karen Hammerberg and also Louise Johnson, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Karen is from the Jean Hales Foundation, and also Louise Johnson is CEO of the Victorian Assisted Reproductive Treatment Authority, or VARTA, both members of the Australian Fertility Coalition, running a campaign to educate individuals and couples in what it takes to conceive of and have a healthy child into your late 30s? What are the issues around fertility for both men and for women? And we'll link to their website. We'll also link to the previous story with Jean Twenge in case you'd like to hear that interview again and read more about some of her arguments. Look, thank you very much for joining us on Life Matters this morning. Coming up next, a little treat from the poetry slam competition that RN's been running in the lead up to the big national comp.
On the Health Report, is the answer to doctor shortages giving GP tasks to your local chemist? Plus fascinating research into kids, like the influence of iron in the diet on brain development, and just what are the reasons some babies grow small, and what can you do about it? All that and more with me, Norman Swan, this afternoon at 5:30 here on RN.
Do you love poetry? Do you love to perform your poetry? If the popularity of the Australian Poetry Slam is any indication, performance poetry is hot. Yes, hot right now. As you probably know, RN has been running its own poetry slam competition in the lead up to the big national comp in partnership with its organisers, the non-profit arts association Word Travels. And now it's time for RN listeners, that's you, to vote. The winner will be RN's wild card. They will hit the stage at the Sydney Opera House on October the 13th, along with the state finalists, to perform in the National Poetry Slam competition. So entries in our little comp have closed. We have six finalists. Your vote will decide who gets to head to the Sydney Opera House. Voting closes this Wednesday at 5 p.m, so you've got to get cracking. We wanted to give you a flavour of one of those six finalists, and here's Helen Rumatzaki with Not In My Backyard.
Not in my backyard. Excuse me, candour, not to rock the boat or take refuge in propaganda before a national vote, but I'm concerned to learn what experts have been thinking, our fair Australia shrinking, to see signs of our dire straits peek past the side gates, the backyards in our new estates shrunk to the size of Barbie plates. I'm on a backyard blitz, won't call it quits till my new pool fits. I'm repelling raiders, keeping out invaders, because the redback spiders are all communist insiders. I have a nightly patrol to control the dusky rat, because in fact it might be a mole. If the flocks of flying fox drive me bats hanging like asylum-seeking acrobats on more than a transit, that's it. Send them home in disgrace to disappear without trace. I'm an Aussie struggler out to defeat the Laura Keaton budgie smuggler. If I can't have the pied imperial pigeon pied for tea, I'll ship it back to PNG. I'm not one to tamper with nature, but I must go overboard to stop the advancing horde. I'm an Australian in Australia. This is my land. The Christmas beetles can go to Christmas Island. The pandanus can shove off back to Manus. There's a reason these trees are without a visa. I'll seize all the plants in the neighbourhood, transplant them down in Billerwood. Grubs creeping under fences won't breach these defences, sailing under eaves on leaky leaves, harbingers of vice scuttling like marsupial mice past the borders of my well-mown, hand-sewn, home-loan patch of paradise. It might sound hard to say not in my backyard, but even the roo is a queue jumper, and I can't vouch for its pouch. What have I missed that might assist a terrorist? There's nothing more to do but shoo the moshal to Nauru.
Cutting and timely, Helen Rumatzaki, with Not In My Backyard, one of our six finalists in RN's Poetry Slam competition, which will leads us up to the Australian Poetry Slam competition. Now, it's your turn to vote. You need to vote for one of those six finalists. I think we've popped the audio up of all of those on a dedicated website. Listen to them all and then vote, and the winner will go to the Sydney Opera House to perform on October the 13th. The thing is, you've only got a couple of days. Wednesday, October the 2nd, that's this Wednesday at 5 p.m, is when votes close. And we'll put a link on the Life Matters website to this story, to the page that you need to go to vote. Please get involved. We've got lots and lots of entries, and it's a wonderful kind of crowdsourcing effort going on here. On RN, on Life Matters, Natasha Mitchell with you. Up next, our modern dilemma.
I think there's a huge issue here.
I can't, I struggle with it, to be honest.
It's like walking a tightrope.
you might feel it's the right thing to do.
How I should say something.
There is a conflict.
I would tend to check that.
I'm muddled on this.
I really struggle with it.
So this is an opportunity to fondle that stray chin hair that pops up, the whiskers above your lips. Because this week's Modern Dilemma is about facial hair. And we'll call the Life Matters listener Uncomfortable. Uncomfortable writes, a friend has an excess of facial hair, which she probably can't see because of her sight. I've tried all sorts of ways of raising her awareness, even suggesting a trip to her local beauty salon of the problem, without any result. Bothersome facial hair is a problem for all of us as we get older, but it seems like a very taboo subject. And joining me this morning is clinical psychologist and author Sally-Anne McCormack and philosopher and author Dr. Damon Young. Welcome back to you both.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Damon Young, what's your first response to this?
Okay, my first response, well, I shaved this morning, just so you all know. I'm in the mood here. Look, first of all, this is not just an aesthetic choice. This is a social norm. This is often seen as a moral duty. So according to some of the research, women saw smooth skin as attractive on themselves, something they just do to feel beautiful, but on others it was a duty, and women who didn't remove that hair were disgusting, to quote the study. Now, in other words, this becomes something you ought to do, and not just on your face. It also becomes something you ought to do on your legs, your arms, your vulva and so on. Now, we are talking about US college students, so let's just bear that in mind. Yeah. But another study suggests that women who had more facial hair will often have much higher levels of social anxiety. They were more self-conscious about their body and so on. Now, the authors...
Really? Or they might be quite the opposite, I wonder. But anyway, go
well,
on.
Well, the authors of the study suggest that the social significance of their hair is what leaves them anxious or worried. It's not the hair itself, it's other people and their expectations. Now, I'd like to get back to the exceptions to this, but we can talk about something else in the meantime.
Yes, we will indeed. Sally-Anne McCormack, I wonder if it's not bothering her friend, perhaps it might be the listener themselves that needs to ask, why is the hair bothering them so much?
That was actually my first thought, was how, you know, is she just simply being judgmental? One of the great things that I'm finding with the ageing process, because I'm approaching 50 now, is that Mother Nature's actually quite kind. And as my eyes are deteriorating, my wrinkles seem to be disappearing and so do my chin hairs. So I'm actually quite happy about the process.
Bring it on.
Absolutely. So, you know, we have to be careful when we... look at friends and think about, you know, their appearance, or we actually may be talking about our own issues and our own fears rather than theirs.
Well, what might be some of her issues and fears? Just to extend the thought experiment here.
Yeah, I think that the woman that is concerned about her friend is probably, you know, very concerned about her own facial hair or appearance, because not everyone does. Not everyone really gives, you know, that much care to how they're looking. One of the things that I would probably do, if she really believes that this situation is something likely to cause her friend some embarrassment, or, you know, the people are going to talk about it, is perhaps raising her own, you know, concerns about herself, saying, look, I've got to go back and, you know, have this looked at, or, you know, have it plucked, bleached, electrolysis, whatever it is that she decides to do.
So but talk about her own hairs in company of her friend.
Her own hair, her own aging process. Yes, and if her friend doesn't bite, then drop it. It's probably your own concern. My only exception to this would be if there's excessive facial hair that wasn't there before, because that may actually be a more of an underlying hormonal issue, and that might be something that you may decide to raise.
Yeah, so, I mean, Damon Young, if she did decide to broach it, I mean, personally, I think she should stay well away, frankly, unless she sees that some harm is coming of it. If she did decide to broach it with her friend, how might she do that?
Well, for me, the important step is for her to step back first and recognise that some people might, as we've said, resist this or simply not care. So, for example, in one bit of research, people who identified as lesbians or as feminists in this particular study were more likely to welcome body hair, let alone just to tolerate it. So in other words, the fear of hair can be something to overturn or reject if you're supported by a peer group or your friends, or you have a strong identity that allows you to sort of rethink what it means. You don't have to bow to social pressure. Now, bearing that in mind, bearing in mind that this becomes an open question now, hair's not suddenly a bad thing, what can our listener do? Okay. She might want to talk first about aging in general. Introduce this as a general topic, not just about hair. How does she feel about growing older? Hair can be part of this, so it becomes actually a mutual self-discovery. How do you feel about this? Mm. What my mother-in-law calls aches and pains, bits of your body that don't work now that once bore, or new insights. What does this all mean? And then you might be able to say, you know what really bugs me? These little hairs right here.
It's an
How do you feel about it?
It's now, a lot of effort to go to.
The reason it's a lot of effort and the reason it's worth it, if she does decide to broach it, is because it's not about hair. Firstly, it's about the existential issues of ageing. Secondly, it's about friendship. This is really about the listener's relationship with her friend and learning more about each other.
Mm.
Now, if she chooses to ignore the issue of hair, which personally I would, well and good. But if she doesn't, take it as a genuine opportunity to learn something profound rather than just policing someone's body.
Yeah, I love that. I love that suggestion. Sally Ann McCormack, what are your thoughts about... Damon made the point before that we ascribe a moral dimension to the hair that we decide to keep or remove. And you know, you often have heard women sort of talk about it as if it's a major task in personal hygiene, you know, removing all that hair. What is it? What is at the heart of that pressure that women and now increasingly men seem to feel? I mean, not everyone feels it, and I think we need to make that clear. As Liz Morrigan is tweeting, she's on a roll. Love your hair everywhere. And she says, there's a woman I know who has lovely soft hair on her face, lovely to touch. And she also says, I am disgusting.
Yeah, look, I think that it's, you know, one of the things that I've written down for myself as a little note is don't be directive, be supportive. She may not care. Mm. I actually had a person actually comment to me about one of my little, or large, actually long stray hairs one stage.
Did they?
At one stage. Yeah, they did. And they said, I always carry tweezers around and, you know, before I get out of the car, I'll have a little pluck at it. And I just thought, gee, that was actually really rude. I frankly didn't really care about it at that moment. And all she did was make me self-conscious for the rest of that day. I think one of, as I said with the aging process, my eyesight is slightly deteriorating. I think that's great. I think that's Mother Nature's design. And I think that we should stop putting our judgments on other people. It is one of the social norms, but, you know, for now, for this current time, that a lot of people are suggesting that, you know, barefaced and actually hairless is one of the things that seems to be, you know, a current trend at the moment, at least here. It'll come and go, and, you know, I think that we're making too big a deal of it. If our friend is happy, they're enjoying their life, they're not saying that people are staring at them as they walk down the street, or they're not,
well, they might,
you know,
wouldn't
fearing
know if their
anything.
Sight is failing them a bit.
But
Damon, finally to you, I have reflected quite a bit over the years on the amount of energy that is expended by women on hair removal that could be spent on so many other exciting, influential pursuits.
Yes, I mean, this is sort of the central theme of my book, Distraction, is you only have the one life.
Yeah.
You only have so much energy and so much time. Do you really want to look back on your deathbed and say, I am so glad I removed all that hair, because I could have been doing silly things like reading a brilliant book or falling in love or spending more time with my children or going for a run? I mean, it's in the grand scheme of things, it is sort of literally and figuratively quite superficial.
Look, I think you're both wonderful. Thank you very much for joining us on the program this morning.
Pleasure.
It was a pleasure.
Sally Ann McCormack and Dr. Damon Young. Sally's a clinical psychologist and author. Damon is also an author and a philosopher. And we'd love to hear from you Get in touch with your modern dilemmas. You can do it via the Life Matters homepage, abc.net.au/radionational. Look for Life Matters and it's all there. You email us. Please send them our way. They can be personal, they can be political, they can be social, they can be of your family, whatever. Coming now to Michael Cathcart. Good morning.
I shaved this morning. I'll never get those 3 minutes back.
I tell you what, a lot of people spend more than 3 minutes.
Well, I know.
What have you got coming up?
Oh, well, we've got lots of things coming up. We're going to look at this question of whether we're seeing a crackdown on artists. So that young artist, Paul Yaw, is facing charges of producing and possessing child pornography. There's been Bill Henson's photos withdrawn from a show in Adelaide. So I wonder whether that's a sign of, you know, some kind of bigger shift or some bigger anxiety towards the arts.
Bigger moral hysteria.
Yeah. And we're also going to look at the snuff puppets telling a story of cultural change in Indonesia.
Oh, looking forward to that very much. That's Books and Arts Daily with Michael Cathcart. And looking forward to your company again next on Life Matters.
I will not be lectured about sexism and misogyny by this man. I will not.
What will be the legacy of Julia Gillard's time as Prime Minister? In her first in-depth interview since losing the Prime Ministership and leaving politics, Julia Gillard opens up to Anne Summers about her time in office and her future. A Big Ideas conversation not to be missed, and you can download it now from the RN website.